Welcome back to another episode of ABA Mom. I'm your host, Allie, a mom of five and board certified behavior analyst. And today I have three guests with me, Julie, Tracy, and Sharon.
Hi guys, my name is Sharon Holloway. I am a Palm Coast resident, have been since December 2014. I am the proud mom of a wonderful 23-year-old young man named Elijah. He is on the autism spectrum. A specific diagnosis was PDD NOS with a significant speech delay. Been a resident of Indiana prior to that, and we just are busy in the community as far as trying to go through this life with, the IDD special needs community and resources and so on and so forth. So it's been a real pleasure, Allie, to have been with you on this show and other experiences so that we can talk about the resources that are much needed in this community. So I'm a full-time working mom, but I have a real heart for the special needs community, not only just here, but pretty much everywhere, because there's a lot that needs to be changed. So thank you so very much for having me.
Yeah, of course. So happy to have you. And Sharon and I were on a previous podcast with Autism Labs as well. So, and that was a great experience too, when we were able to discuss some of the needs and starting up like a respite or a group home and some of the requirements and some of the challenges that we could possibly face with some of those. Tracy. And Tracy's been on my show before when I first started. It's been almost a year now since we've had this podcast going, and Tracy was one of my very first guests.
That's crazy. I forgot about that.
Yeah, I know. We did like the history of ABA, I think.
I liked that. Yeah. So now since then, I'm a board certified behavior analyst. And then and then I have my master's in social work. So now I kind of bring a mental health background and an ABA background. And previously, before living in Florida, I lived in Missouri, where Missouri has waiver programs and for autism and intellectual disabilities. So in different kind of in a group home setting, and then kind of working for the state of Missouri, that's who operates it there, have had exposure to like waiver programs, funding sources, just different ways that they contract out different programs. So been working in the field for a while, and I just very much enjoy it. So I'm very excited to be alongside you guys and interested to get to know Julie and learn about her experiences and want to see what I can learn from that.
Yeah. Julie, I think we're all really excited to meet you. I know Sharon brought us this awesome connection with you, and we're just really excited to hear about what you do and your background and how you've been contributing to special needs community.
Well, I'm Julie, and I met Sharon and her wonderful son, Elijah, when we were in Indiana, and I was running recreation therapy programs with an organization in South Bend. And as a recreation therapist, we work with the community with people with different diagnoses and different disabilities to help them live their lives better, and mostly in the community, that they live in. And so I have 24 years of experience as a certified recreation therapist, but I've been working with people in the field for, I figured it out, 37 years, which I
Wow,
think makes
that's
me
awesome.
old with all of my And then all of my experiences I've done have been programming, and I've run departments as well as a whole organization. I've taught college courses about recreation therapy and experiential therapists working with an organization called Charlie Health, and that is providing virtual mental health services for individuals nationwide. And so it's been a really cool platform to be part of for the last 3 years, almost 3 years, and being able to do recreation therapy to anyone in 37 states. So I'm loving it.
Thank you so much for being here today and all of your years of experience. That's incredible. You worked across many different environments. So like you've worked in, it sounds like schools, group homes. Did you say virtual classes as well? You've done virtual. And how has that shaped kind of your approach? What kind of approaches work best for you? And like, how has that shaped like all your different approaches that you've used to work with the community?
Yes. So being able to work with the community, it's been really great. Reaching out, mainly connecting the community partners together. For example, when I was teaching recreation therapy, we would provide class projects with the students who needed fieldwork experience. I would then connect those students with different residential facilities to provide their recreation programming. And so the students needed the fieldwork hours and the experience. It was supervising them that way, as well as teaching them how to do that in real life experience. So that was the benefit for the university. The benefit for the rest of us, you know, be able to do these great programs with each other. And you know, the residents were getting new faces, which is so important, and making friends and them telling them about their Special Olympic, you know, sports and showing meadows and, you know, to be able to have that wonderful connection and communication and all of that. And it's in the community and in their home that they live in. So it's a win-win for both entities for sure.
And I think what you do is very interesting, and you might be one of the first therapeutic recreational specialists that I've ever met in my life. So can you kind of share, I know you shared a little bit about how you help the community.
Sure. So in the position that I have now, we have recreation therapy curriculum that is evidence-based, research-based to be able to get connected with assisting our clients that are part of an intensive outpatient program. And it's all virtual. And so we run everything on Zoom currently. Our platform is Zoom. And so in the morning, I get up and take my kiddo to school, take care of our animals. We have lots of animals to take care of in the morning, but then prepare for the day. So I'll go through and I'll say, all right, I have 6 groups I'm going to be facilitating for today. Here's this group. Here's this group. All of my groups are permanent groups. And so I have known them from day one in the program. Who are in the program are there for 9 to 12 weeks. And they get to see me. Each group gets to see me once a week.
That's
looking
awesome.
At how do we, and like, how do we show our authentic self to each other. And so we do a masking project. And so we do, you know, how are we with our mask on? How are we with our mask off? And for them to color and design, how are they showing to the other people? As well as then, how are they being their authentic self when their mask comes off? So that's just one example of many, many different options that we can choose from. So I do that until 2. Then we usually have meetings from 2 to 4, have a little bit of a break to get our family settled and things like that. And then I have evening groups as well, and groups 6 days a week. So mornings and evenings.
And what would you say if somebody was starting like an adult day training program, what would you say would be some great skills for them to kind of start to like work on? Or what do you think is like a really a need for a lot of the clients you work with? What area would you say?
Living skills, communication skills, and you know, if I'm looking interpersonal, living skills, communication skills, conflict resolution. Those are always the top 3. And then if I'm looking at living skills, then it would be, you know, job readiness skills and to how to help them navigate this world, which is harsh you know, and so with the living skills and the communication skills and conflict resolution, I always bring that into, hey, let's make a game of, you know, making a routine of our ADLs. And what about communication skills? We have so many different ways of how to help people practice those and, you know, to be able to role model those different ideals. An organization that has a workshop that's kind of connected to it or anything like that, but anything that they would have job coaching for, you know, to be able to say, not working in the workshop. I don't think that's the answer. I really never have thought that was the answer. I believe people have to work out in the real world, you know, and so let's get everybody job coaches to help them work in a real job and make a real wage and to be able to do that and to feel independent and understand all of those processes that go with that. That's the way of how we can assist everybody to be as independent as possible in their community.
Yeah, I agree. I like what you said about the conflict. I think those conflict resolution, those social skills are certainly important. The job skills are important. And whatever kind of the needs are to kind of get them ready for life in the world, I think all of those things are very important and essential. What would you say for somebody, if somebody wanted to start up an adult day program or a life skills program, what would you say the best startup might be? What has your experience been as far as like the billing process?
Yeah. So the organizations that I ran and operated actually helped start up. They went from very small. They were there, they were existing, but I was able to take them from very small to take them to the next level. And a lot of that was figuring it out and figuring out community partners and connections and billing and budgeting and all of that in between. The strong thing that is currently going on right now is if you're wanting to start up a residential to become a nonprofit, because that would be where you can get grants and things. Number one, you need to find funding. You know, that's huge. And to be able to find funding, the funding sources and the grant sources right now, they're looking for collaboration. So, you know, gone are the days of where one organization is going to be able to go and it's just me. So you have to go and get connected with your community partners to show that collaboration and to be able to say, well, look at this. I have this partner now doing as our mission or our vision. So that I would say would be number one, you know, find somebody who has a collaboration, has a similar vision or mission and collaborate with them to be able to do that. And then that would help you be able to secure funding. That would be your next step. And then it would be, as you all know, you know, Florida, Indiana, Missouri, Illinois, we all have different rules. All of our states have all these weird restrictions and rules. I really wish Illinois had waivers because that would just make things so much easier. But so you would have to know all of those roles as well. So to kind of navigate all of that, I would first connect with, especially if you're needing to have a startup nonprofit, the way of how I was able to get a lot of my legal questions answered was the networking, as well as I joined our community foundations and they had all these great network events where, you know, they taught you all of these great things. Also, if anybody is near a state and federal funded university, their business department will always have, it's called a small business incubator, and they will help you work out a business plan and figure out the legalese and, you know, do budgeting and where do I need to find grants. And even some of them have memberships to the grant funding, what is it, like the clearinghouse, the website that costs $1,000 a year to belong to. you have access to that. So all of that, you know, resources, you just kind of have to find your networking way for a little bit. But I have known parents who have gotten together and created their own nonprofit and said, we want something better for our adult children, and created this, and they were able to purchase a house and have it, you know, accessible, furnished and created with ADA, and started their own program because they were not happy with what was out there and what was available, and to be able to help support their adult children. That is where I see the trend going right now, especially in our world that we're working with, is we are seeing families who have adult children going, my child can do so much more. I want them to do so much more, and more than what is being offered right now. So what can we do to do this? So there's a huge uptick in that movement. And so it's really exciting to kind of see it.
I love that too, that it's just, it's a lot of parents with adult children that want to see change, to want to see change in your community.
It's like the parents are saying, like, they're more self-directing their care, you know, and their services, like, you know, they're taking on as an employer, you know, and saying, yes, I want you to be hired to help my child, or, you know, like, instead of before, like, you know, you have to wait for people to come to you, you know, it's different. Like, families now get to kind of self-direct their services. I really like that. So if that makes any sense, I hope. I believe though, Julia, my question kind of was, had you ever used like HUD housing to help get the, like, a residence for any programming?
So not in the programming that I was involved in, because we did mainly the recreation part of it. But what we were able to do was connect with the facilities that had HUD housing available. And we were able to, our organization then came in to their community room that they had at their facility, and be able to provide programs for their residents that way. From what I've heard, how do I put this nicely? From what I've heard, HUD housing is really difficult to get. And I have helped a lot of families. I wrote letters, recommendation letters. I've worked with this family for many years, and, you know, blah, blah, blah. And yes, they receive, you know, scholarships from our organization. And so as much as I could help be an advocate for those families to do that, for them to find housing or to find placements. Another hard thing that a lot of families are doing, having to deal with right now, is the parents are getting older. And now what? You know, we aren't physically able to take care of our adult child anymore. So what do we do? And when I used to work with families of young adults, I said, you need to get somebody, you need to get them on a waiting list. Because it would be, in Illinois, it is 5 to 7 years to have a spot in a residential facility. And what is going to happen with, I had this discussion with a family, with an organization I used to work with before this. And, you know, they were an older couple and they were taking care of their granddaughter. And I said, what is going to happen? You know, you are over 70. Well, we'll be fine. I said, no, she needs services and you need to get this set up for her. And unfortunately, their health declined very quickly and it was a big struggle. And I helped try to find emergency placement, but she was placed finally 2.5 hours away. And so that's the whole other thing, is limited beds, they call it. You know, this is a spot or a bed. That is what we are seeing. And that's reality, is family members aren't getting placed close to where a family can go visit. And so, you know, that is also another issue. As for HUD funding, that is like a whole different animal, I'm sure, that I have thankfully never had to deal with. But I do know of a lot of people, organizations who have had to, you know, over here to get accredited because we need to get, you know, our residential facility credentialed, you know, to be able to receive funding and things like that. I've talked with a lot of colleagues about how they go through that process for sure.
Is there any way I could jump in just real fast on that? Because you know, that's very near and dear to my heart, right? So everybody knows my parents are in their mid to late 70s, right? Dad just turned, my goodness, 79 on Christmas Eve, and mom is 76. And as you probably heard me say on the other podcast, they are my son's backup caregivers, right? So when I have to go to work, you know, he goes over there. And fortunately, there is a emergency solution here in Florida for the waiver program where if something happens and you need to get bumped up, you can. My thing is that, and it's kind of a startling statistic, but here in Florida, I think the last tally that I saw was over 22,000 clients waiting to be serviced on the Med waiver. Flagler County as a whole is like, I think they had taken like 300 new people, new clients last year or the year before when I was running statistics. 300 in a pool of 20,000 is nothing. You know what I mean? And everybody is going to be an emergency at some point. You know, I'm not here to blast the system. It's just kind of, we need to kind of shine a spotlight on the thing. Right. So when you're dealing, and mind you, you're in a state that doesn't even have a waiver program. So how do you then parse out what's an emergency and what isn't an emergency? You know what I mean? Because what is an emergency in my household may not be considered an emergency to an entity that is responsible for placing. Does that make sense?
Yeah. But there's critical ones like homelessness.
Yeah. Homelessness. So my child will have to be homeless at some point in time. You know, it's and
a very critical
loss of the cord.
I think, yeah. My experience.
Yeah.
Well, in Illinois, they call that the PUNS list. And that's the 5 to 7 year waiting list of people and waiting for services. And so you should be recommended to put your child on that list as they're in their transition plan in school. But schools forget about that sometimes. And so, like in this instance of the granddaughter, she wasn't even on that list. And so it was trying to figure out how to work everything through. And understandably, once you do get services, you're able to get housing reimbursed and services reimbursed to a point. But yes, if there's emergencies, you do get up the list and what defines an emergency, all of that as well. So, but if you aren't on that list and then all of a sudden you have to be on that list, it's, you know, it is a scramble. And it's something that a lot of families really have no idea about because people just don't tell you about it. You know, they don't talk about it. They're finally talking about it, at least in the programs that I was working with, starting in like middle school. That's about where you should be starting the transition program in school. They should be talking about getting services and here's this option and availability. It's very frustrating, yes, for families. And so then other organizations have to step in to help advocate to be able to help them get services. Yeah.
So where does, without the waiver, where does the funding come from as far as like the placement for these clients?
So in Illinois, since we don't have a waiver, it is federal funding and state funding, which it's all cut, you know? I mean, literally, you know, politics play a huge thing in, we're going to cut services. How does that work? You know, so funding, they're able to be supported by different organizations, nonprofit organizations. and support themselves to as much as they can, utilizing social services and things like that. But in Illinois, it should be able to supply that funding and support to families.
And one thing I was really interested in sharing that you mentioned is that she's professor, Julie, you're a professor at Chicago State University, and that mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. sometimes have, or you've seen other facilities and programs like use students to help in with some of these programs that they're running. So in what ways have you seen the students utilize it? How does it benefit the students and how does it benefit the organizations?
Absolutely. University side, of course, it's benefiting the students because our students, especially any student that is going to be working with people in a medical kind of profession, they have to, within their college life and college experience, have field work experience. And then usually they have internships. They require field work experience to go and become experienced working with people. And so by doing that and in my therapeutic recreation classes, I would go out into our community and we were able to get contact with and connected with residential facilities and two nursing homes. And I said, my students need experience coming in and doing programming with your population, and your people would love my students and, you know, to be able to enjoy somebody new and fresh coming in. So let's do it. Let's make this collaboration. And so it was paperwork, sure, you know, and the students had to go do background checks, of course, and all of that. But it was beautiful because not only were we giving the students that wonderful experience of getting into the community and supporting their community, learning and putting what they have learned into action under my supervision while we were going to the different facilities, but then the residents were able to get experience having that awesome communication and connection to the students. And so much to the point of two of our students asked if they could continue to volunteer after our semester was done. And then one got hired on as a part-time activity assistant in the nursing home, the retirement home, because they loved her so much. And so it was a beautiful connection from the university, and then a wonderful connection for the residential facilities to be able to have people come in and do great things, you know, go, oh, that's a residential person. I'm not talking to them. You know, that stigma that's out there that I hate. Right. And just treat them as their people and, you know, and having fun and talking about the Cubs game and, you know, what about this? And, you know, how's your football team doing? Oh, they're awful. You know, that kind of stuff. And so that is now the challenge of me doing that at Chicago State, and to be able to say, hey, we have these awesome students that need field work. When I was teaching the course before, it was working with older individuals. So we sent our students to senior citizen day programs and the Y's and, you know, for them to participate and to get that exposure. That's so important.
Yeah.
No, it's just a win-win for everybody.
Yeah. I think that's a great experience. It's great for peer modeling too, to have that experience too with younger people. And it sounds like, you know, as far as the nonprofits or other organizations too, that it's also helpful to have volunteers because there's always a need for extra bodies, always a need for extra staff. So I think that's really important. And everybody kind of learns from each other. So the students are learning and then, you know, the residents are learning. So everybody's learning. So I love that model too, to have the students involved. Someone starting up, they were going to kind of make the choice between like a respite or a residential facility, what would kind of your recommendation be? What would be the highest need out of those two right now?
I would, If you're wanting to start one, you absolutely need to have your nonprofit. And so that would be the first step. And that takes a bit, but like I said, you know, the small business incubator helps you along the way. A friend of mine just did it for her organization. She said it took about 6 months. And so she put it all together to submit it. They went, we don't like how this is dotted or the T is crossed or whatever, you know, and then she resubmitted it and it took about 3 months after that. And then it was fine. So that is number one, because if you are going to try to get any kind of funding, you need to be a qualified 501c3. Then you start applying for the funds. And as you're applying for funds, start your networking, you know, start reaching out and saying, hey, I've got this great idea. Here's my business plan. So you've got to have that business plan first and have it all set out to say, this is what I'm going to do. And once you show your business plan to your connections, they're going to know you're serious. And so you do your business plan, you get your connections, you have your collaborations to apply for your grants. During all of that, start connecting with your parents and saying, hey, this is what I want to do. You know, are you interested in getting in on this vision? And, you know, this is what we're planning on doing. And we have, you know, 6 beds in this house or whatever, you know, you would choose to do. It does not have to be a brand new facility. I have seen so many homes, you know, retrofitted to be able to do that at a much lesser cost than it is, especially now, to build. And so that absolutely could work too. So as you're, you know, building things like that, you definitely have to look for a place. And to be able to do that, there's so many, at least around where we live, there used to be 4 organizations that had residential facilities. Now there's 2. And so they moved around their people, and there's alone in the little town that we're close to, there's 3 empty houses. And so I don't know if that is nationwide of how the kind of the move is going, but you might be able to pick one up and for a lot less expensive, you know, than a house and retrofit it. But that's where I would start. And then, you know, with the inn and you're moving in and everything, get them connected to their community connections, like the independent, the Center for Independent Living. I was going to say it wrong. The Center for Independent Living. That is where you would get your job coaching, and you would be able to have advocates to be able to help them, you know, find jobs and actual restaurants and working environments, not warehouses or, you know, workshops. So you would get them connected with them that way, and social services. And it definitely takes a lot to get going. But if you look at it and you have that set business plan, because that's what a lot of people are going to want to see, is they're like, okay, what's your business plan? So you would go through those steps first. I think once you have it all set in place and you're like, hey, we're ready to do this, you know, parents, let's do this together, it is going to be so busy because there's such a high need for something like that. The groups that I know who have done this, and, you know, the parents have created a board and they are the ones making these decisions. But then the residents, their adult children, are also making the decisions. They get to say, I want my room pink, you know, or I want my room purple, or I want this job or whatever, you know, and they are all making these decisions like a village. It's the coolest thing to see.
That's awesome.
I love it. I mean, the parents, it's such a community, like the parents together. And I love that they're like creating a board. And I think that we have so many parents and, you know, adults, we already have kind of a little community, but I just would love to see everyone get together and make such a difference, like in our community, and be able to have that extra support, because it is such a need. And I think a lot of times what we kind of talk about is at some point they get older and it's like, where are they going to go? What are they going to do? And that's a scary thought, of the fact that you have a child with a disability and then you don't know who's going to take care of them when you're not there anymore. But it's nice to know if you have a community and they have a support system and they have somewhere to go. So I really love that. And I love your experience, Julie, being able to grow that community and being able to support one another. So thank you so much for your time today and your expertise. It is much needed. And I appreciate everything that you're doing. Thank you so much for being involved and doing this for so many families.
I do have a question. Can I throw a question
out there? Absolutely.
It fills my cup.
One of the things that, and you kind of made a really good statement about, like, once you actually start forming the nonprofit and you start putting your business plan together and so on and so forth, then you kind of like devise and you know, more articulate what it is that needs to be done. Would you agree or disagree that the decision at this point in time between a respite care facility, like a respite home, versus an actual residential facility for focusing specifically on life skills would be a decision made during the proofing process of building the business plan?
I would say you would definitely have to make that decision, because respite is very different than residential, although both are so heavily needed, right? Because respite to me is, I need the weekend off and I need someone to be able to watch my son or daughter that I can trust. And so I'm going to bring them to this facility so they will have the time of their life while I go take a break and then go pick them up on Sunday. Where residential, that's permanent. And so I know for a fact there's different standards for that, but I also know there's a camp that does that. You know, they have somebody come in and they do 1 week residential camp, but then they also have respite weekends. And they are going at the same time. And so I would say, for your business plan to be as clear as possible, you could say, we're going to do a residential house first in phase one, and then maybe phase two, add in the respite as needed, and have that as, like, you know, a second chapter or a phase two. You know, businesses always have phases. And so, you know, you have your starter and then you have your, okay, I'm going to advance up to this now. And so that is a typical, you know, a step ladder for a business. It would be, I would say, this is my plan for phase one. And then in 2 years, we're ready for phase two and add that in. But I think with your business plan, to have it all encompassing, because your business plan is supposed to be like this huge umbrella that explains exactly what you're going to do. And you can have little departments and little phases within that umbrella. But the worst thing to do is to restart a new business plan in 2 years. We're going to have a whole new business plan. People are going to be like, because who have already invested and become partners, and they're like, wait a minute, that's not in your original business plan. And they might get a little uneasy. But if you put it in there as, this is the next phase, this is what I would like to do, and you are building and planning for that phase, so then it's really easy for you to just step in. That would be super simple.
Yeah. I think that makes a lot of sense. And I think on some level, it kind of makes sense to have the residential first, because you already have the rooms, you know who's going to be there. I think from a business aspect, like, it kind of, the stability part makes sense, versus because for a respite, you don't know who's going to be there, how many people are going to be there, et cetera. And maybe even opening up like a bigger space too at some point. Like, I think that kind of makes sense. I think you really help kind of define, like, you know, that could be phase one and then have like a phase two. So I think that part is really important too. So Sharon, thank you so much for that question. That was good. I like that we touched base on that too, to talk about the residential and respite, because they are very different, but like you said, they're both very much needed too. So they're
absolutely. And I agree. You kind of have to think of it as, and then the respite could be emergency respite as well.
I like that idea too.
And of course, like keeping in mind too, that, you know, I know there's a technical definition for respite, but there's so much of a need for the adult day program facet. It's kind of like you want to paint the world with this very wide brush, you know, and how do you figure out what is the most important thing that makes the most business sense and can be done as quickly as possible, you know, and you don't want to do it wrong, right? You definitely don't want to do it wrong. You got to be able to be intentional, and you have to be able to be almost foolproof, as much as taking a chance can be foolproof, right? But you also want to be able to serve as many reasonable cases as possible without over or underestimating. Does that make any sense? It's so many things at once. And I, like my dad always said, shoot for the moon. If you hit the stars, you've done well, you know, that kind of thing. But, or whatever it is, you know how that saying goes. But you do want to aim high, land somewhere moderately in between, but, you know, keep your expectations humble at the same time. So, yeah, that's kind of where we're at right now.
No, I think that was a great picture of kind of, like you said, where we're at, and just trying to, I think where we kind of are is just doing our research, is just finding out like what is the best way, so that way, because you're right, it is all a chance, but then just discovering what is the best way to do it without trying to mess it up, doing it the right way. And it has to, from a business perspective, it has to make sense, but we also want to serve, you know, people. And I think the biggest thing, I think that where our heart kind of is that life skills piece, getting them ready, those independent functioning skills, all those things that are very much needed to kind of, you know, survive, to like be a part of the communities, like the things they need, because there's a lot of job training. There's a lot of things that's like, okay, this can get you ready for a job, but maybe there's like a piece where it's like, they're not ready for a job, or they lack in this one skill, but they're really great at this. Like, where can we go to, like, now that they finished the school program, to kind of work on that skill? So I think that part is really important too. But what we've kind of discovered is starting like an adult day programming by itself without a residential, without respite, doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It almost makes sense to have the residential or respite program and then an adult day program too, where everyone can kind of be included as well outside of the residence. Do you agree, Sharon, too?
Oh, sorry. Yes, absolutely.
I don't know who's frozen and who's not.
No, but I completely agree. Yeah. I completely agree. If not anything, because the experience of being in a residential setting away from the family unit, right? Because we all know that sometimes, you know, when Elijah's at home and he's in his room, he knows exactly what he's supposed to be doing and nothing else, right? But as compared to when he's out in the community and he's at his job, or he's taking care of, you know, himself and another person's home, he knows that his expectation is a little bit different. So I think a residential, you know, facility of this nature gives them the comforts of home, separates the familiarity, the mom and dad aspect, the grandma, grandpa aspect, whoever the family units are, the guardian aspect, and takes that potential member, client, individual into another level, because then they're getting nothing but learning. They're getting nothing but support. And it kind of gives them the ability to stretch their wings and be able to be more independent in that level. Because we're the ones that hold them back, right? We want them to run, not too fast just yet. So I think that a program like that would be a lot easier for.
Yeah, I agree too. And out of the home, like a home setting versus a community setting versus somebody else's home always looks different. Different environments, like different behaviors in different environments. Like they may do things differently, especially if they're taken a little bit out of the comfort zone. So like, you know, something different than playing video games, like at home, we get very comfy, you know, and I think that's important too. And I know residential programs, they do have like a requirement for those community outings as well. So I think that's like that's a huge piece too. It's being able to be out in the community, different expectations out in the community too. Yeah. So Julie, I just wanted to thank you so much for your time today. And is there anything that you feel, I feel like you've been such a great asset and you kind of help with all of our, we've had a lot of conversations. And they're kind of all over the place. We're kind of making decisions and we're really on the research stage of things. So I really appreciate your time and your expertise as well. Is there anything that you want to share for us or listeners that you think would be valuable?
Yeah. I would just say, you know, start number one, look into like the small business incubator, because that's going to save you so much time and money because they do it for free for you. And so to be able to say, here's our business plan. Okay, they're going to rip it apart and then you're going to put it back together again. Literally your business plan, your 501c3 will take forever because you want it perfect, right? And so that's really what I would say would be your first step, is to get in touch with the experts on the things that, you know, you're not an expert in. We know how to do a lot of things. But the other things, I'm like legal and, you know, accounting and that kind of stuff. I want to find an expert that's going to help me start creating that framework so I don't have to redo it four times. Because, you know, our time is valuable as well.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I agree. I appreciate that. That is an excellent piece of advice. And that's something I wasn't even aware of. And you said the best place to find like a small business incubator is at a college, like a state college or?
Yeah, any college, any state funded college that has a business department, they should, because all the ones that I have accessed, that was the story. It's called a small business incubator or something like that, because it's funded by the university and it truly is to the community to be able to support the community small businesses. And they'll be upfront with you and they'll say, this is not okay. It's not going to fly in this community, you know, or what's your area that you're wanting to serve. And they're great about that. So, you know, I had a couple ideas shot down by a couple of them. And, but now I'm like looking at the bigger picture and I went, oh, I'm so glad they said no, because I can see what they were seeing now. I just wasn't there yet. And so, you know, trusting in that experience for sure. But just, yeah, I would say try to get to the closest university, state-funded university, or it might just be universities. I'm not sure, but I just know the ones, and that's about it, I guess. That would be a good first step.
Julie, thank you so much. We appreciate you. And thank you, Sharon. Thank you, Tracy, for coming on today. And yeah, we'll see you next time. And just remember that you are not in this journey alone. Till next time.